fleeting glimpses of things seen through a veil, darkly. Do we understand the meaning of these visions of life? Why we are here and how little of our existence we truly understand? Tonight we will talk of these things on The Other Side.
Welcome to The Other Side. I'm Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again. And we have a return guest back from 2019. I was telling her that a few things have happened since then, but I'm so glad to have her back on the line to talk about her latest book, The Ninefold Way of Avalon, Walking the Path of the Priestess. And our guest today is Jenna Talendru. She holds an MA in Celtic Studies from the University of Wales, Trinity St. David, and has a bachelor's degree in archaeology. She founded the Sisterhood of Avalon in 1995 and serves as the academic dean of the Avalonian Theological Seminary. She hosts residential training retreats around North America and the UK, presents internationally at conferences and festivals, and teaches online workshops and immersion programs, and facilitates pilgrimages to sacred sites in the British Isles and Ireland through mythic seeker tours. She is a priestess in the Avalonian tradition and has been for around 35 years. Jenna has been following a pagan path since 1986. You can visit her at, and I want to make sure I get this right, YNYSA Fallon, FALLON.com, and www.sisterhoodofavalon.org. Jenna Talendru, welcome back to the program today.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim. It's a pleasure. And, a few things have changed since last we spoke, for sure.
Oh, okay. Yes, indeed. Well, I guess I would start off with saying, you know, obviously, the other than the things worldwide that have changed in 2019, what has changed for you and your practice?
Well, you know, it's a great question. I think a lot of people wound up making use of the technology, just like everyone else, getting on Zoom, doing a lot of virtual events, which have been kind of fantastic. I mean, you know, there's nothing like in-person gatherings and things of that nature, but the fact that we can reach people worldwide, people who wouldn't otherwise be able to travel for whatever reason, and we could bring in teachers from all over the world, we could have students come in from all over the world. So it was just in many ways, although so many of us were in isolation, I think it was a broadening of community, strangely enough, thanks to, you know, the magic of technology.
Yeah, it was amazing how many people that I've talked to over the last couple of years who said, we found the programs during the pandemic because, you know, because people were tuning in and looking for different sources of information, entertainment, knowledge, whatever it might be. And so many people, for example, not just my programs, but the world of podcasts in general, so many people found it because they were seeking connection. And I think you're right. It's one of those things. I think anybody, you ask anybody, we wish that what happened wouldn't have happened, but it did. I would agree with that. I think it did broaden community in many ways. Now, on this latest book, The Ninefold Way of Avalon, Walking the Path of the Priestess, I would like to start off first with the concept of Avalon, which many of us think about from the mythology of King Arthur and so forth. But how does it play into the real world for pagans and for your practice?
Well, it's a great question, and I think that the core piece of it is that a lot of pieces of culture attach itself to the story of Arthur, and he helped preserve it for us. And so Arthurian tradition is, you know, over 1,000 years old, and a lot of different story traditions became attached to it. And Avalon is like that. So while the Avalon that we've received down the stream of tradition that is Arthurian tradition is likely never have been a true place, it is the recipient of many different confluences of cultural pieces. So there is a historical strand to it. There is a reflection of cultural needs over time. And so the story shifted and changed. So what we've received today is kind of different from its origin point. But I think studying the journey it took from the beginning to now kind of gives us a sense of why Avalon has been so evocative in the imagination of people, that it persisted in literature over time. And so we receive a very, very potent symbol set, a very activated, otherworldly realm, if you will. And I think that, it has a reflection of the Grail Quest in it, has a reflection of ancient pre-Christian Celtic practices. It has, just the imagination piece of it. And so all of those things can serve to inspire us today and kind of give us a sense of, it fills the same need. I think that's the piece of it. Myths endure because they have something to teach us, and things that no longer are relevant culturally tend to fade away. So yeah, I think there's something about tying into something that's ancient and yet timeless, and still be able to see a reflection of ourselves in it.
Now, some people may hear this, walking the path of the priestess, and think, well, I am interested in a more spiritual walk, but being a priestess, that sounds very intimidating to me, and I don't know if I could ever be a priestess. Well, what are your thoughts on that, and how would you define priestess, and is it something that's accessible to all women, for example, or is it something that's only for a sacred few? Because when you think about a priest or a priestess, you think it's a very kind of select group, but is this more accessible than that?
I think it is, because in my mind, there's a difference between clergy and being a priest or a priestess, as far as my perspective goes. And
okay.
I think that there is something to be said for, when we think of a priestess, when we think of an officiant of rituals, of rites, of celebrations in community. We think of someone who, in pagan tradition, does divination, is an oracle, is in service to the gods in a way that also serves community, so facilitates rituals, performs healings, things of that nature. And all of that is attested in the lore. However, one of the things that comes up over and over again is the fact that, first of all, there are these enclaves of nine women that we see over and over again show up in different lore streams, and they all have different and multiple gifts, multiple functions. And so I believe that the definition for me, first of all, is that priestessing is a verb. It's something we do. It's not necessarily something we tick off. It's not necessarily, and others will, this is my opinion. So not everyone has the same perspective, but
sure.
I feel that to be a priestess is to be a bridge, to bridge between what is and what could be, to bridge between this world and the other world, to bridge between the individual and the collective, between the person and the divine. And it can extrapolate out between wisdom and knowledge, between ignorance and knowledge, between suffering and healing. So to be a priestess, I think we need to redefine it somewhat to say it is anyone who serves is as a bridge that assists in crossing others, helping others cross thresholds and to cross thresholds for themselves. So part of what I do with this book is try to redefine the sense of priestessing. And I outline using, lore and trying to back up with, what we know from history, this ninefold energetic that we see over and over again. And I outline nine different kinds of paths, but also recognize that these nine, which in cultures of Indo-European derivation seems to indicate a wholeness. That's probably why we see so many iterations of nine. It's a complete set. It's the end of a cycle. And so nine is a wholeness. And so we see wholeness through the nine, both within us and outside of us. So I think anyone can be a priestess if they approach service from a you can infuse, I think, sacredness into anything. To redefine what that means, I think, opens up a whole realm of possibilities, not only to whom it is open, but also what form that service takes place.
Is part of this reclaiming women's power, for example, in more kind of society, is kind of went through its paternalistic phase and the emphasis on the man and the de-emphasis, unfortunately, on women and the power of women is part of this reclaiming that power?
Absolutely. In Arthurian legend, there was a focus on sovereignty. There is a whole story about Arthur needing to find out what women want most. And he learns that what women want most is their sovereignty. And what's interesting is that in that part of the mythos, women are seeking sovereignty from men, from the men in their lives. But in the more distant past, women or the feminine principle were the givers of sovereignty. They were the manifestation of the lands that a king would rule, and he would have to be tested by the sovereignty figure, a goddess or a priestess perhaps, and be shown to be worthy, and then they would engage in a sacred marriage. There would be this transferring of power, a bridge between what the old order and the new, and he would be infused with the sovereignty of the land. He would be granted the right to rule. And what we see is when those rights to rule can be rescinded when the king is not in right relationship with the land. So, because as the king goes, so the land goes. So sovereignty can be taken away. And I think that there's no coincidence that Avalon and other women's empowering traditions are arising at this time. And they have for several decades, I think, or more. It's because we are collectively not in right relationship with this planet. And, you know, in Arthurian tradition, the rape of the well maidens, the flouting of hospitality caused the wasteland to fall upon the land. And I think that's what we're seeing now with, you know, if you want to extend the metaphor, that the wasteland is literally descending upon us, the fires and the flooding and the this whole global catastrophe that we're walking into. And I think it's time for us, perhaps it's part of that memory that, you know, half of our population is not being listened to, half of our planet is being, subjugated by very few for very selfish reasons. So, I think there's a connection between those.
In the book, you talk about the Nine Sisters of Avalon. Who are they?
Well, that is a great question. So the first time that appears in print is from Geoffrey of Monmouth in the early 12th century. And he names them, but he almost created these names. They all kind of indicate this watery etymology, all of their names, but they're names that don't appear elsewhere. So there are traditions in many different Celtic paths of these nine. They're not always named. And so what are they? They are sometimes the nine witches teach heroes to fight. They are sometimes the nine sorceresses that lay waste to the land. Sometimes they are the nine maidens of Anuven, who are essentially muses at the cauldron of inspiration. In Avalon, they are the nine rulers of this land, nine sisters who rule together, and chief among them is Morgan, who becomes Morgan le Fay over time as the tradition evolves. The other sisters seem to fade away a little bit, but we think there are resonances of them in the myths as the ladies of the lake. And so they are these entities that take different forms, but I think that they are guardians of this ninefold pathway. We can be in relationship with them in different manifestations in different ways. So they are amorphous. They are these watery threshold guardians, and that's part of who we seek to come into relationship with, to emulate in our practice.
Now, I think sometimes when magic is mentioned and so forth, that people have the perception it's about me, me, me. What can it do for me? But you talk about being in service. How is that important, and what forms does that take?
So we take this tripartite view of service, that first there needs to be service to the self, but not in a me, me, me way, but in a I'm going to achieve wholeness. I need to understand who I am, to be real with myself about my fears and my limitations and also my desires and my gifts, to become whole and aware of who we are. And that way we can be in better service to our communities, to others. And that, I believe, is best done when we know who we are, we know what our right work in the world is, and so that we can be in service, whether that is that's as a teacher or a healer or a tender of hearths, a raiser of children or a caregiver, whether that's as a scholar or an activist or any of the number of ways that can manifest. And then there's that service to the divine, and I think that that's the thread that runs through all three of them. That I personally believe that the things that burn in our heart, the things that we feel passionate about, are placed there and deliberately, and that we are meant to follow our bliss, to follow our dreams, to manifest our passions, and in doing so, we're doing the work of the divine, of the universe through us. We're kind of that mediator, that bridge, and so yeah. So it is service, though, but it always comes down to this for me. Whom does the Grail serve? What am I pouring my energies out in service to? And it's not meant to be in service to the self, although, solely, is that when we receive gifts, we call it the Awen in Welsh tradition, which is divine inspiration. It's meant to be poured out into the world, this creative force, hopefully to make the world a better place, to be active co-creators of the world. And so to be in service in that way.
This particular book, is this, and I kind of asked this question in a different way before, but not quite. Is this book something that's accessible to beginners, or really do you need to be into paganism and this is kind of like a continuation, or can the newbie, the beginner, pick this up?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I call this book my mullet book. So it's got all of the academia in the front and kind of the practice in the back. And so what I tried to do is I gathered, if you're interested in Avalon, if you're interested in Arthur, if you're interested in Celtic culture, in the evolution of story and myth over time, I think you'll find this book interesting. Yes, it does focus on this piece. And I go and I research so in depth all of the source material. So if you're an academic geek like that, you'll love it. I think if you're just first coming upon this tradition, it gives you a good grounding, because I think there are a lot of books out there that come from heart, that come from spirit, but aren't always rooted in the academic piece. And so I try to present that there. The back of the book, though, the second half is an engaged practice, and I think anyone can pick it up. However, it does require part of what I was talking about earlier, that discernment of self, to know the difference between the voice of our fears and the song of our souls. And so that can be attained in many different ways. And the reason for that is because it is a guided practice, but it goes into places that one builds upon the other. And so, some skill, I think, with meditation is required. And it does integrate with the other two books that I have on Avalon that I've published with Llewellyn. So this is kind of the third in a series. They interlock, but I think someone who's really motivated, I think, can just jump right in and start here, especially if your true heart interest is that Arthurian, that cultural, that Celtic, Iron Age, Druidess, Cirrus, historical piece. I think you'll love it.
You talk about the ninefold path of the priestess, and you list out the various paths of lore keeper, law speaker, emissary, artisan, hearth tender, guardian, seer, healer, ritualist. And it occurs to me that many women in my life, not necessarily pagan, but I see them filling many of those roles. In terms of those different paths, how do they relate to women, and is it necessary that they pursue each and every one? Are you saying that people are better at one than the other? Maybe that's what they're drawn to. Can you talk about these paths, and if you have to take them all simultaneously, or you can gravitate to the ones that kind of suit your soul, so to speak?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I really honestly believe that the more important piece is to integrate the ninefold aspects of the self. So we do begin by reflecting it within. Again, nine is a whole. So what are the component parts of the self? What is our relationship with our sense of boundaries, the guardian? What is the status of our home fire? Do we have the resources that we need in our lives? Where is our physical health? What do we know about our past, our story? So all of these nine aspects, I believe, are of the most importance when they're reflected within us, when we can use them as a way of self-evaluation, of inner balancing. And then that is part of that discernment I was speaking of earlier. And then there are particular ways of manifestation of outward service. Sometimes doing that inner work reveals, you know, that outer path. But here's the thing. Yes, it's not like a Hogwarts situation where you get, you know, sorted into your house and you stick with that. Some people know ultimately that they want to be that scholar priestess and they start there and stay there. Some find themselves kind of, you know, manifesting different things at different times in their lives. There's no limitations on it. But I will say this. Each of the nine have the nine within it. They're very this ninefold process is very fractal in a way. And so there's, you know, we talk about nine, but there's, you know, nine times nine, you know, iterations of this. There's a multitude of ways of walking it. That's part of the reason why I talk about that discernment, because it is self-guided, but only you know what is your manifestation of this in your life. And so, I think that I think it's as flexible as people want it to be or is drawn to it to be. There, it's a form that gives shape to an approach, but it doesn't need to be limiting. But yeah, I think that nine within is the important piece first before progressing.
Now, we haven't really used that term that much, but I'm assuming that magic plays a part in this. But to you, what does magic mean and how does it manifest in people's lives? I mean, again, those of us of a certain age, particularly me, remember, you know, Samantha and Bewitched and wiggling her nose and all that. But, you know, over the years, although I'm not a pagan or I'm not a magician, but I've certainly talked to quite a few over the years, the energies seem to be far more subtle than that, but still real. Can you talk about that?
For sure. I think that for me, I ascribe to that definition of magic as the ability to change consciousness in accordance with will. So it is about that that mental magic, that manifestation through intention. And I'm not a spellcaster. I don't, you know, that's not the kind of magic that I participate in. Mm-hmm. I know people who get really great results with those sorts of things. But this is a more of you said, of a more subtle kind. It is, bringing forth the Awen, that divine inspiration, and pouring out into the world to be in service as a cauldron kindler or a grail bearer. To affect change in the outer world in accordance with will as well, but also in service. It's always a service of, you know, again, a pouring out of carrying that vessel of sovereignty. So yeah, magic is about change. It's about that creative spark that flows through us.
Now, obviously, this is not, if you see this book, this is a significant work. It's not a thin book. It's not a small thing. It's a lot of work, obviously, went into this. I happen to believe, even when someone is very experienced in an area, as you are in all of this, that when you do something of this magnitude, that you learn something, or maybe something surprises you. Was there anything like that, or multiple things like that?
You know, this is definitely not the book that I started off writing. I've been, the material in here is a result of over 15 years of practice, but the writing of the book and pulling together of all of the sources, it definitely changed how this wound up manifesting. But I think the thing that that shook me the most in this is that, you know, in Irish tradition, there is a lot of talk about druidesses in their lore and in their myths. And so it is a given, and there are a couple of other pieces too that I talk about, you know, this proof of druidesses. I just kind of accepted that to be true. But when I went to look at the sources and I looked at the Irish mythos with an eye, like my studies are mostly on the Welsh material, so I haven't gotten into the depth, in deep into the weeds with the Irish as much as I have with that. But to look at the understanding that the word druid or druidess in the Irish lore does not necessarily mean the same thing. It means one who wields magic. There isn't that spiritual or religious component that we see in the early druid traditions that the Romans wrote about in the first century BCE and CE. And so, the idea that there were women who were in these positions of seers and poets who had foreknowledge is definitely something that is reflected in the lore, but it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing as what, you know, we think of druids as these, you know, these learned priests and sacerdotes and all of that. So what I wound up doing was kind of disproving druidesses in history, but not that I disproved that they existed so much as I think our concept of them is not accurate to what we do know. And, you know, absence of proof is not proof of absence. And that's a given across the board in anything you're studying or researching. But I wasn't expecting to kind of blow some of those so-called proofs out of the water. So I do believe the Celts did have women who were serving as in these druidic roles, but we have more proof, not even more proof, but the proof that we do have tends toward these holy women, these priestesses, and not perhaps necessarily directly druids. I believe they probably were druid women, but that the Romans never wrote them down, and we just don't have proof of them elsewhere. So that was a surprise.
So in a moment, we'll tell people where they can find the book and more information about everything you do. But first, any final thoughts about the book or this particular path of the priestess?
I would say this. I think one of the reflections I get the most is I get men who contact me and they say, you know, I really love your work. Is it okay that I do it? Or, you know, is there something for me in here? And the reason why this is one is because the lore is woman-centered, that Avalon was tended by 9 women, that there were these priestess enclaves, but these women weren't in service to their communities. And so it's not like men couldn't come and be healed on Avalon. I mean, that's kind of the whole core connection with Arthur. So I think that if you're a man, and, you know, I know I spent my life reading about things that are a flipped gender for me. And I think that if you are interested in these topics, even if you're not necessarily interested in the practice, that that you shouldn't shy away, because it is speaking to women directly. But I think that anyone who reads it can get something out of it, especially if this is something that you're interested in, you know, this culture and this mythos.
Well, if you're interested in it, certainly we've been talking to the right person today, Jenna Talendru, with this new book out, The Ninefold Way of Avalon. Jenna, where can people find the book and more information about everything you do?
The book is everywhere. It's published by Llewellyn, so you'll find it in your brick and mortar. You'll find it in your online retailers. I always, you know, please do get it from your independent booksellers. And I am online. Jim kindly gave my website. It's innisavalon.com in the Welsh spelling, which is great because no one else has that, but also it's difficult for people who don't speak Welsh to remember. So Y-N-Y-S-A-F is in Frank, Allon.com, or my name, JennaTalendru.com will also bring you there.
Excellent, excellent. The book is The Ninefold Way of Avalon, Walking the Path of the Priestess. Our guest today has been Jenna Talendru. Jenna, thank you for joining us. It's been very compelling and very enlightening.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me, and blessed solstice to you. And I appreciate this time.
And thank you for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.